Welcome to the Apartment Operators Podcast, where you can learn from experienced operators what it really means to be an apartment operator. No fluff, no sugarcoating, just the raw, unfiltered truth of the ups and downs of operating multifamily communities.
Welcome, everybody, to the Apartment Operators Podcast. Today, we have Aaron with us. Aaron, welcome to the show.
Hey, how you doing? Glad to be here. Excited to be hanging out with the big dogs.
Thank you for the compliment. But really, we start the show, every show, with giving our guests the opportunity to introduce themselves, take a couple of seconds, and just, you know, how'd you get to where you are right now, How does your portfolio look like? How many units? What kind of multifamily you guys like to do? Just so the audience will know who we're talking with.
Yeah, for sure. So I am 50% or 100% owner in around 250 units, Midwest, Kansas City area. And the niche that it fell into didn't start out intentionally, but the niche that it fell into is 10 unit to 75 unit, 70 unit complexes, stuff that's probably too small for the institutional investor and a little bit too big for the normal single family type of duplex person. And this, most of the stuff sourced direct to seller. The reason behind that was just the niche that felt that I fell into. When you get in this game, a lot of this stuff is broker relationships, and it takes a little bit of time to develop those relationships. So as a, you know, the mover and shaker that I tend to be, I wanted it now. I wanted out of my day-to-day job, and I wanted it today. So I went the direct-to-seller route, and it allowed me to cultivate relationships directly with them and get in the game quicker. To be honest, that's what it was all about. It was a 200. I read a book. $200 per unit per month in profit. And if I could get to 20 units, that'd be $4,000. And it was literally just a unit stacking game. And since then, I've learned, obviously, that is not what it's all about. But we can get into some of the pitfalls of that. But that's how it started. How do I get out of this grind? How do I enjoy life with my family? And how do I replace that income? And you've heard, which is true, but I'll add to it, you've heard that you make money when you buy real estate, but I would argue you really make money when you operate real estate. That's the key.
Yeah, we say it a little bit different. We say you make your money when you buy, you lose your money on operations.
Yeah, exactly.
That's just another way to say the same thing, right? So really, this is why we created this podcast, is because all the other podcasts I've seen out there when we started was all about buying and raising money and underwriting. But this is just a sprint, right? When you to get to the closing table, and then you start a marathon of operations. And there was nothing out there that was talking about operations. There was nothing out there that talked about the horror stories, the challenges, the things that we meet every day when you're actually with the boots on the ground. So that's how we started this podcast, is about that. What is your total count of units right now?
256, I believe, currently. So okay. No syndications. Those are 50% or 100% ownership. Yeah.
That's fantastic. And are they all in the same kind of geographical area, or they're spread out?
Yeah, it's about Kansas City. Take Kansas City. You got a few hours one direction, a few hours the other direction. Honestly, they could be states away. And the management or the operational management is the same. I think it'll get into one of your questions, but we use third-party management, but it's like a hybrid situation. And the reason really is because there's multiple reasons, but I feel more comfortable moving and scaling to a different city or MSA if I can vet a property management company and then utilize our system overlaying their system, right? The current portfolio is all in linear markets in the Midwest, C to B minus class assets.
So, yeah, you really got into our first question that we always ask, is third party versus self-management. And you mentioned some sort of a hybrid model. So tell us a little bit more about that.
Yeah, so let me start with saying, so let me run you through how this came about. So I mentioned this was a unit stacking game in the beginning. It was all about relationships, finding the deal, purchasing the deal, and repositioning it, quote unquote, stabilizing it, handing it over to a third party manager that we worked with through that process, but then pull out the money and totally focused on the next property. So that was, yes, I would look at, so hear me out here. We had a 16 unit we started out with, a 32, a 36, and so on. When that 16 unit was done, it was placed with management, and the mistake was focusing on the next deal, due diligence, repositioning it, right? All of the new stuff that came with the other property, and totally disregarding that first property, and then the second property, and then the third property, and then you got a 21, and we got a 10, and a 14, and literally just kept filling up this conveyor belt of properties and not asset managing at all. To be honest, I missed the whole podcast on asset management, the entire book, the entire chapter. I was like, that's a pretty interesting saying or word. I'm sure the property managers do that. We vetted them after all. So let's just trust them. Yes, we'll look at a report once a month. A report comes across, and if that's all you're looking at, you're behind on any active decision making that would fix the problem. And you look at, we just found ourselves with this big conveyor belt of properties, and everything was not meeting the metrics that it should. And that's when we began going back and looking, okay, what are we missing here? Obviously it was the asset management side of the deal. And by that time we had four or five different property managers in different areas, and those property managers, we had to actually let go, almost all of them, because when we revamped and implemented this system, it was just too far gone, right? They were doing their own thing, and we had to move on. So now the system, to answer your question, the hybrid system is basically a system where we require them to follow our system, which it is not a property management system, but we require weekly meetings. We require interaction from them with our shared doc per complex. And we have, just to get into the meat and potatoes of the actual process, each complex has yearly goals. We have quarterly priorities. We have weekly to-dos that I, as the owner, set for each property management company in each complex. Mm-hmm. And then we go through all the other metrics that are pretty common. We've got all the financial metrics, the leasing metrics, and all those things. But the goal is to be able to take a look at a property from a distance and see the yellow lights flashing before they become red lights and address them quickly, right?
Yeah. And how do you go about finding those property managers that will come in and they'll take over a small property? Because a lot of the big ones, they don't want to deal with the 16 units and the 20 units, and still convince them that while they take over management of this property, they're still going to have to step into your system, even though they might be experienced with years of experience and having their own systems and processes. Now they have to work with you. So how do you go about finding those property managers?
Yeah, for sure. It really helps them. And once I can gain their confidence that we're a team here and that we're more organized and that I'm here to help, then it goes a little better sometimes. But I will give it to you. A lot of these property managers have this A type of personality where, oh, you don't trust me, then, you know, I'm going to do it my way. And that's fine. They can be that way. But we're going to move on to the next one. And we just want to make sure that, and they're out there, people will be happy about following a system that's more organized and this, and in our experience, but you just have to continue to look. You're right. These smaller properties are a little different because, as you alluded to, the larger complex, so let's say 100 plus, you need a resident manager, and it becomes a totally different management play, or a little bit different. And then you have these, let's say 16 or 32 units or 36 unit. So long as our asset management system, I feel like, is functioning, we can take maybe a property manager who has more experience in just the smaller multis and really plug them into our system and still be effective. So that's just what we found so far.
Okay. So let's say you found a new 30 something, 40 something unit property, which in my opinion, by the way, 40 is just about the worst, hardest kind of property to manage, right? It's not small enough to be able to run like a mom and pop. It's not big enough to afford full-time staff. So you find yourself somewhere in the middle there. And it's one of the hardest sizes, I think, to manage. So let's say you got one of those properties and you put your plan in process. What do you care about, or what are you looking for in that property manager that would be willing to step into your program? What kind of questions are you asking? What kind of referrals are you looking for? How do you just, if it's a new city, a new MSA you've never been in, how do you go about finding them and what are you asking?
Yeah, that's a good question. So we're really just rolling the dice, finding managers and setting appointments. And we like to meet with people, management, potential managers, as if we can in person while we're there, boots on the ground, and just the typical management questions. We want to go through what their process looks like. Do they have any systems in place? What do they do when evictions come up? Are they legitimate property managers? And if they are, great. Then we say one of our requirements is to follow our system, right? Basic, it's real basic, but it is a little bit more than probably they're used to. Are you willing to send us metrics on a Friday to update the Google Docs on a Friday and then have Monday morning meetings with us, weekly meetings, to just touch on the touch points and move through this together? So we really don't have any new questions or any new processes that when it comes to that. It's just some of these managers are totally in over their head. They literally are at capacity with 12 single family houses, and those are not the ones we're looking for. They, you know, ideally, they have a team in place. Ideally, they know they have good systems and operations already.
Gotcha. What kind of asset classes you're in right now? So is that C class, B class, A class?
Yeah, it's pretty much all C to B minus, which there's a lot of negatives with that, but there's a lot of positives. We'll start with some positives. That asset class you cannot build any more of, right? So if we can provide clean, safe, functioning, lower rate home communities, then theoretically we will have demand for those in any market cycle. But the negative is the CapEx and the work cost the same as it does in an A-class property. So the HVAC system's the same price, and you're going to get less of a return on your investment in the demographic. And then we all know how C-class tenants are, right? So sometimes that's the negative as well. But it'd be great to roll into some larger properties and upgrade the current properties. But we should be able to cash flow. We should be able to hit that mark, that metric of $200 per month profit in C-class assets that's not over-leveraged.
Yeah, I'm not going to skip the fact that we're recording this in August of 2023. So we have the end of August. So we have interest rates that are skyrocketing up at least 3% since last year. We're in an environment where I haven't seen, at least in our market, haven't seen the sellers come to term with those higher interest rates, and they're not budging on their prices. So how does your world look like today? Are you in acquisition mode? Are you in let's hold and see what happens? Are you a seller? What is your outlook with what's going on with the market right now?
Yeah, that's a good question. We are continuing to market to direct to sellers. And we are currently in negotiations with a 28-unit apartment owner. So a small mom and pop, the guy built them himself, you know, the perfect candidate for what we like to buy from. But the only way this pencils out is he is going to hold the note himself. So it's an owner finance deal. So do a down payment directly through the owner and have a 5-year term on a 30-year amortization. But other than that, we are a long way away from the sellers when we're looking at new acquisitions. And you hit it on the head. It's the interest rates, and it's still a divide in the market here. But you mentioned, what do I see coming up? I do look at this pretty deep, and I do study, and I do have some ideas. I don't think that this, what we're going into, is going to quite be like 2008. But you got to remember, in the multifamily sector, Fannie Freddie had less than a 1% default rate in the financial crisis of 08, 09, and 10. It wasn't a multifamily crisis. It was a single family crisis. We are multifamily investors. So what do we see coming in our sector? For me, I believe this could get a little shaky. And if interest rates stay high, there's a stronger chance that people will have to do cash in refinances. The hottest thing, what, for the last 4, 5, 6, 10 years was cash out, refinance, and roll. And I'm afraid that there may be some liquidity crises ahead. So we're trying to prepare, although we want to continue looking, we are trying to prepare for higher interest rates for a longer time.
Yeah, no, I agree with you. And I've been vocal on social media and LinkedIn and so on about what I think is coming. The challenge is for multifamily, the way I see it, is that in the last 10 years, we've been in a world where rents are skyrocketing every year, 5, 10, 20% year over year in some cases. And inflation has been steady 2, 3%. But in the last 2 years, we've seen inflation go out of control and hits the 6 and 7 and 8% mark. And I know people say the CPI is now down to back to 4 and something, but CPI includes stuff like cottage cheese, right? And we don't buy cheese for our properties. We buy sheetrock and paint and metal and lumber and our labor, and all these things have gone a lot more than 4% in the last few, couple of years. So we get into a situation in the next at least couple of years, in my opinion, where rent growth is now slower than expense growth, which means you can have a beautiful class, say 98% occupied, stabilized, and you're losing value every year. And that's really where what's going to really make the difference, and this is where our podcast kicks in, is it's only the top operators that's going to survive this. If you are a mediocre operator, if you are inefficient in your operations, then and the last 10 years would have easily overcompensate or hide those inefficiencies by the rate of the rents growing up. But with that party is over, I think there's going to be some murky waters ahead for the people that are not operators, not strong operators. I think some of these people are going to struggle, even if they don't have a liquidity event ahead of them.
Yes, I agree. And this is all cycles. These are not new. These just may be new to the newer operators, even like myself. But you may have been through the last cycle, and I really wasn't investing then. I started in 2018, 2019. But I do study history, and I don't think most people do that. These are cycles. And the only people who lose in cycles are the ones who have to sell, or in our sector, have to refinance or have a term, a liquidity event come where they have to roll over debt. So that's what's different between the single family world is there are a lot of terms that will be coming due in this world or in this sector, but it's a cycle. So we're looking at it like, how do we just make it to the next cycle and continue our rent, stabilize our rent, or keep it stable, if not increase? Which, if you look back to the last crisis, the rents actually continued to go up. There was a spike in vacancy, but rent rates never technically went down. So that tells me if you can operate effectively, your rents are going to hold steady. So you should be able to easily weather the storm, right? Here's an analogy. If I bought a McDonald's franchise or any franchise, and I paid $1 million for it, and that business generated 250,000 in true profit every year, and I'm moving along with my business, everything's great. Some event happens in the fast food market over here, and some guy comes up to my door and says, "Hey, you're not going to believe this. Because of what happened over here, your McDonald's is only worth $500,000 now." And I'm going to say, "Why do I care? I'm not selling. It continues to make 250,000, right? It's only for the people who sell, have to sell. So how do you position yourself in a way where you won't have to sell?" And that's through exactly what you said, operational systems. And for us, we chose to operate other managers as opposed to create it in-house. But we have looked both ways. I know your team, and you guys do your own in-house management, and I'm sure that works great. I've looked at this, and I might like to get your opinion here. It seems like it's a huge headache, and it really, like you say, really fries the brain, right? And for little reward, I'm wondering, for 10% maybe increase on the NOI, would bringing it all in-house really work? Right now, it's not worth it for us, but do you think that's a fair metric? 10%, is that what you think you'd see?
Here's the reality check on things, right? Yes, you're right. It's more of a brain damage than a profit center. But as a property management company, if they don't collect $25,000 a year, the meaning for their income is about $1,000 a month, Which is not not $1,000 a month. It's $1,000 total. It's about $80 a month at a 4% rate. But for you as an owner, if you take the bullet and you spend a little bit more than what you get in for the management fee, and you get to $25,000 at a 5-6 cap rate, that's $50,000 to $100,000 value to your property. Is it worth it for the money that comes as a management fee? No. But can you impact the valuation of your property? Yes. That's one thing. The other thing is, you mentioned people that have to sell. I've seen some really interesting things going on recently, because right before everything went sideways towards the end of 2022, people were, like you said, cash out refi. They were doing those refis with maximum leverage. And those lenders would let them go maximum leverage, which means they were barely scraping the 1.25 DSCR. What we're seeing right now is we're seeing multiple properties or loans going on the watch list of those lenders, even though the properties are like 93, 94% occupied. And you look at it and you go, why is that property, which is fully stabilized, going on the watch list? And you realize it's because they dipped from the 1.25 DSCR. That's really where even properties that are, again, fully stabilized, operating, I would say 94% occupancy is stabilized, can still get on the blacklist with the lenders, the watch list, and even go to receivership if it dips under a certain DSCR ratio. And you know what? It's surprising how easy it is for a big property or even a small property to cycle down to a lower DSCR with just a few people leaving, right? It's even worse on the smaller properties, right? Because if you have a 20-unit property, four people leave, now you're at 80% occupancy and your DSCR can take a major hit. So that's the kind of things that we're also a brokerage, right? So we talk to clients all the time and we tell other operators right now, if you're at 1.5, 1.6 DSCR, hang in, right? Brace for impact. Watch your dollars. Watch every penny that leaves your pocket. You can weather the storm. If you're below 1.5 DSCR today, honestly, we tell our clients, sell and get out of it. Because what we see coming up down in the next 2 years, if you're barely on the 1.25, 1.3 DSCR these days, chances are you're not going to survive it. Again, my opinion. That's what we tell our investors. That's what we advise our investors right now. But it's not pretty. It's just not pretty.
Yeah, I agree with you. And that's admirable. We have to be proactive in that, because there's a lot of people still out there, buy as much as you can. And I'm not trying to be negative, but I want to be prepared.
Yeah, and you just got to increase your safety margins and increase your buffers, right? When you underwrite, when you approach things like this, and that's really where it is. The other side is, of course, you might buy it on a thin razor margin, but you find a great opportunity for value add. And assuming that the refi is going to be there is a very high risk assumption at this point. We've seen what I see is, and I have been around the last cycle, we see a very similar situation to what happened in 2008 and 2009, where it's kind of like a race to the bottom. And on one end, you're getting better prices. And on the other hand, you get less and less funding sources. The funding sources are drying up. So like at the end of 2009, there were great deals out there, residential, commercial, it doesn't matter, but there were no funding resources. So if you were hoarding cash, you were kink, right? You bought phenomenal deals. But if you didn't have cash, finding a lender that will give you the loan was very challenging back at the time. So that's what we're seeing right now is people that are coming in better have a very strong plan with emphasis on the financials. So I'll give another example. I have a mentor of mine, somebody that's been doing that for over a decade, very strong operator, and he just bought a $35 million property, but he raised over $20 million. And we were having a conversation, and I go, you realize that 2 years ago, if you raised over $20 million, you were buying like $80 to $90 million properties. And he goes, yeah, I know. But this is what today's world allow us to do. This is how we safeguard. This is how we're going to make sure everything is done. And yes, the cash on cash is going to suck for the next few years, but we'll be there on the other end of the cycle with strong IRRs and great value add. So it's just a different strategy. As long as you're conscious about that, there's no reason why not to buy. You just got to buy right.
Yeah. Yeah. I was just going to add to your comment about the loose and tight monetary policy. So like in 2008 and 9, the rates dropped to zero, basically. And by all intents and purposes, if you look back at a chart, everybody should have been refinancing. But to your point, there's no, the banks were tight. No one was lending, no matter what the interest rate is. So I've caught myself thinking about, man, if rates go down, I'm going to refinance. I'm going to pull some cash and add some liquidity reserves over here. That's not how it's going to work. That when if rates go down, something in the economy is broken, and it doesn't matter what the rates are, the banks won't be lending. And so that's what we're trying to prepare for. But you're right. I don't think, if I've learned anything, it doesn't ever get quite as bad as you think it's going to, and it's never quite as good as you think it is.
Yeah, no, I think you've hit the nail on the head, right? A lot of people say interest rates are going to go down, they're going to go down. And be careful what you wish for, because if you're thinking interest rates are going to go down, it means we're going to hit something really hard on the bottom, right? Before we get to the quantitative easement, the drop of the interest rate. That means the Fed was able to annihilate a ton of jobs. It means the Fed was able to basically slow down the economy to the point of now they have to turn around and re-incentivize the economy. Yeah, it's not pretty. Let's talk a little bit about value add. What do you guys like to do? We always ask our guests, give us some ideas of how you increase income. We'll turn around and talk about decreasing expenses in a bit. That is not the usual, okay, we come in, we raise rent, and we apply RUBS. So that's not like a given. But if you have a few more examples, that would be great.
Yeah. I don't have a lot of earth-shattering ideas, but really the income level, in my opinion, it centers around cultivating a community and having actual people who want to live there and would like their neighbors. And they're willing to accept the rent increase. They're willing to take some to stay, go the extra mile to stay, right? We could go through storage and parking and things like that, but most people know that. I do think that cultivating that community feeling is lacking. And we are looking into that, ideas, tenant appreciation days. It doesn't cost much to cook some hot dogs and hamburgers and have something where people can come by. And Halloween is a good time to have some giveaways for whoever decorates their balcony the best, or maybe a trunk or treat, whoever decorates that the best. Just something that gets people out of their units and mingling as a community. It really helps morale in the community. Another thing that I would say is we've been looking at this. We haven't tried yet, but we've heard about some people moving to move-in fees opposed to security deposits. And those move-in fees, I go directly to the NOI, the income line. They don't have to be held in a separate account. And you know all of the turmoil or all of the problems that happen from time to time when a tenant thinks they're getting back a certain amount and then they're really not. And so there's a lot of back and forth there sometimes when people move out. But if they know in the beginning this is a move-in fee and not a security deposit, then we can put it directly toward our top line, then we're looking at that.
Yeah, and there are products out there like Rhino and stuff like that. It's basically like the tenant pays 20, 30 bucks a month, and it's like an insurance. It adds a little bit more of a hustle for the operator when somebody's moving out and there's a damage, you got to file a claim and so on. But it helps with not asking for a big deposit moving in. So that's something that you can work together with the move-in fee to make sure you cover your bases, right? Now, you mentioned a community, but you also mentioned earlier that you have small communities like 16, 20. How do you get a 16 unit property, give them the sense of community? That's hard, right? We have a 22 unit that we manage, and it's not that easy to get we don't have a pool area. We don't have stuff like that where we can do all these activities, the parties or whatever. Like the little things that we do, and you mentioned Halloween, is we'll do a little baggie with candy and stuff like that, and we will leave it on everybody's doors on Halloween and stuff like that. But any other ideas where you help get that smaller community, get them the sense of know your neighbor kind of thing?
Yeah, you'd be surprised how many people already know their neighbors. And it's the return on investment for that effort is just less for the smaller community, because you've still got to pay somebody and you've got to set up a little tent or whatever you do. The giveaway, your return on investment's less, but it still cultivates the same community feeling. So it might just feel like it's not worth it with a 16 unit or a smaller complex. But we're on the side thinking that it's still worthwhile and try to put something together. But you're right. There's actually something that I had heard from one of your podcasts before. Apartment Life is a company that helps cultivate this community. And so actually had a call with them. And so they have are in our area, and they're, I think we're thinking about enlisting their services to go around and help us with all the complexes as a whole in one general vicinity to help with that problem right there. The small communities not being, the return on investment not being worthwhile.
Yeah, and that's another factor to your question earlier of getting and moving into self-management. You got to have a critical mass, right? You got to have enough units in one location. If your 250 units are across four different states and the biggest concentration you have in an area is 40 units, it's really hard to justify self-management. But that's what we had when we pulled the trigger. We had over 500 units in one city. So the greatest distance between two locations was like 3 miles. So we were able to put together the team, build that functionality that can service the multiple locations, so we were able to pull the trigger. But when you have multiple smaller ones and they're spread thin, you're right. It's challenging to make that decision of, okay, I'm going to move to self-management 100%.
Yeah, for sure.
You mentioned earlier, it's not always rainbows and lollipops, right? It's not always super easy. It's not always, oh yeah, $200 per door every month, like clock, and I'm good. Tell us a little bit of the challenges you're facing as an operator of multiple small properties, because I'm sure those challenges are not the same challenges as the guys that operate the 200 and 300 unit properties.
Yeah, so I would guess my biggest hurdle currently is the fact that I'm doing about the same amount of work on a small complex as far as asset managing as I would with a large complex. So I almost feel like I have 6 to 8 different properties that I have to asset manage separately in different scenarios that really just drain me. But these C-class tenants, as the economy changes and shifts, they're the ones that usually feel that first. And so therefore us as owners in C and B minus assets potentially feel that. And then as things get worse in the economy, historically, the people who maybe lose their house or lose their job and have to downsize will come back in. But there's a delta there that I think we're going through now, where maybe the C-class tenants are starting to get a little more squeezed with the cost of living. And like I said, it hits them harder. So we have that hurdle to move through. And then mainly it is the fact that I alluded to earlier, that the CapEx and all of the expenses are the same as if you're in an A-class property for the most part. You mentioned Rhino. We are looking into moving to Rhino because of this reason. For instance, we have a complex that's average rent's $900 a month, but our average turn is $1,800 a month or $1,500 a month. We collect a security deposit that doesn't cover in the event that they lose their entire security deposit, right? That it's tore up or just a basic turn. So we really, that's my day-to-day is staying on those numbers, right? We cannot go negative when someone moves out, and we're averaging 25 to 30% churn rate, which is another thing that wasn't calculated really correctly in the beginning by me. That needs to be allowed for. And so it's a lot of the little things, but that's the nuances of apartment management, operating the operators. That's what you're alluding to. That's what this what you do is trying to bring the light that a lot of people aren't talking about this stuff. It's go stack units. Life's great. I'll see you on the beach. Really, it's maybe you got it figured out. Send me an email. This is like that game that you play where the little heads pop up and the kids play where you just keep popping down the little heads. Yeah. And then that's what my life is. But it's just a phase. And as you get through it, the properties go through. One property's great for 6 months. And then one property, gosh, what is going on? But that's the reality for us.
Yeah. And you know what? The smaller properties, and we talk to a lot of operators from all different kind of sizes. The smaller properties have advantages and disadvantages, right? On one hand, your expenses are actually higher because you don't have an on-staff maintenance technician that is AC certified. So if when you have an AC issue, you got to call an AC technician or hope that the guy that you have managing the apartment complex has someone on staff that is AC certified. But at the same time, what I've learned on the smaller properties is that normally they are easier to turn around than the big properties. And I compare that to the 20, 30 unit property turns around like a speedboat, but the 200 unit property turns around like a tanker. Right? It takes a lot more radius and a lot more time, and a lot more money to turn a large property. There's pros and cons, but I agree with you. That's why we do this podcast, is to let everybody know, hey, it's not all rainbows and lollipops. And if you're taking somebody else's money to buy an apartment complex, you need to be willing and ready to actually be the one that puts their eyes and puts their hands on everything and control this, because otherwise nobody's going to care as much as you do about your property.
Yeah, exactly. And you mentioned the smaller properties. I'll just add a little story. So I purchased a 10-unit apartment building, and it was, by all intents and purposes, a great tenant base. Really excited about the property. The only thing that really there was to immediately add value with was to implement RUBS. And we went in as a team and implemented RUBS, and they had a community meeting, and every single person moved out of this complex. It was crazy. Little events like that. What's the answer? Just always have a little bit of extra liquidity. That's the thing that's done me the best so far, is just, you never know when the rainy day's coming. Have a little bit of extra liquidity. You don't have to put all your cash into the next deal. You'll feel okay sitting on a little bit.
Yeah, a reserve account, in other words. Mm-hmm. Every property should have a reserve account. Yes, absolutely. Okay, so we're getting up to the top of the podcast. Tell us in a few words, if you went back in time and met younger Aaron, what would be the best advice you would give yourself?
Yeah, for sure. So turn the radio off and start feeding yourself with educational material. Focus on whatever it is, younger me, and decide what you want to do, and then focus and educate yourself. Turning off the radio was one of the most basic things to do for me that probably catapulted me into a new realm in this thing. And I know it sounds basic, but if I'm feeding myself with podcasts like yours, with audiobooks, with educational material on how to underwrite and how to do this, that is what I'm going to inherently get out in return, is what I put into myself, right? That's probably the most important thing. Focus on whatever it is and educate yourself. But a practical piece of advice is to turn off the radio and turn on podcasts. I haven't listened to the radio in I don't know how long. So just trying to keep that drive and move and shake.
Yeah, I'm exactly like you. It's funny that you said that, because I used to commute to work, but let's say 2 hours a day on the road back and forth. And I did the exact same decision you did. I turned off the fictional, the entertaining podcast, the radio station, and I turned on the business podcast, the audiobooks. And you can get a lot of content done in 2 hours a day, which, again, it's the right decision. It gets you the information that you wouldn't otherwise consume, and it will open up opportunities that you wouldn't otherwise know they even existed. So that's a great advice. What advice would you give now at the end of August 2023 for someone that hasn't started their multifamily career and they're interested in getting in there, right? They've heard some podcasts, they read the books, they participated in the Facebook group. Now what? What's the best advice you can give someone like this?
Yeah, go find the deals. Don't sit idle. There are people that are going to need to sell, And there are people who have paid off assets, just retiring. They're always that demographic, no matter what the market cycle's doing. You have to hustle. Find the deal, you'll find partners. Send me an email, you find a deal. I'll underwrite any deal that you send over. We can go through it. But go find the actual deals instead of being scared to make any moves, right? This, the people, as they get more and more, as there's more and more pain, potentially, if what we think actually comes to fruition, the operators aren't going to be on podcasts saying, hey, my whole world's falling apart over here, I need to sell. But they might talk to you if you have the hustle to go find them, right? So who knows? It may be a little bit harder than before, but there's always deals.
Yep, you're right. And everybody's looking at social media. And guys, the people that need to get rid of it, they're not putting it on social media. And it's kind of, you're only going to see celebrations, whether they're real or fake, on social media. There's not a lot of people that tell the stories of, this is how I almost blew up, or this is how I lost all the money. There's a handful of honest people that do that. But for the most part, everybody's just celebrating whatever they can celebrate after. So that's a good point. So, Aaron, if our audience wants to reach out, figure out where you are, if they can send you an email with a deal to look at, a partner or something, how can they find you? And we'll make sure to put everything in the show notes.
Yeah, the easiest way is just go to my website and send me an email, securemultifamily.com, and you can find me on social media all over as well.
Awesome. Aaron, it was a pleasure. Thank you so much for joining the show. We appreciate it.
Yeah, I appreciate it, Joseph. You're the man.
Awesome. And for you, the audience, if you want to listen to more great podcasts like this with strong operators like Aaron, feel free to subscribe to our YouTube channel, to Stitcher, SoundCloud, iTunes, and leave us a feedback. We appreciate it. Thank you, and we'll see you on the next one.
Thank you for listening to our show. If you want to enjoy more episodes, please subscribe on iTunes, YouTube, Stitcher, or SoundCloud. For questions or feedback, please visit our site at www.aptopr.com.